Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
Welcome back to the show, team. My name's Amelia, and today we have an awesome returnee guest. We have Laura, who is back to have a bit of a catch-up chat. How are you going today, Laura?
Wonderfully. I've had a great day. How are you going?
Oh, pretty good. Thank you. I think it was quite a good day. Not as warm as Cairns.
Well, to be fair, there are a few places that are as warm as Cairns.
Yeah, that's fair. So we spoke a bit under a year ago, and you've had quite some adventures since then. What's been happening?
I have had heaps of field work since we last spoke. I've done two of my three field seasons in that time. And last we spoke, I think I was about to head overseas to do my field work in the tropical Americas, because my project's comparing the native and invasive range of a plant. Well, comparing the plant-animal interactions.
Do you mind just giving us all a little bit of a reminder primer on the plant and what plant-animal interactions are?
Absolutely. So I'm using SicklePod, or Centroptera folia, as the model system, which I'm trying to compare a number of theoretical ecology hypotheses. So I'm mainly testing the enemy release hypothesis. That is talking about when a plant is, or when a species is introduced to a new range, theoretically it loses its co-evolved enemies, so it should have a competitive advantage in the native range. And that's why it should be able to establish there and outcompete the natives in that area and become invasive.
So thinking about like common blackberry or something would do really well in Australia, because actually I have no idea what its natural threats would be, but nothing knows how to eat it sufficiently, and so it's just going to go brrr everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. So that's fair. A pretty big and one of the more tested hypotheses in invasion ecology. You then have the inverse of that, where if you've escaped from all your mutualistic partners, then theoretically you shouldn't do very well when you're introduced to a new area. Because if you rely on a mutualist to reproduce or to have some beneficial interaction, that's what mutualism is, then you're at a disadvantage compared to the natives in that new region.
Also, like, theoretically, makes a huge amount of sense.
Yes.
I feel like they don't coexist as concepts too well, though.
Well, yeah, it's funny to think about, because it's like the benefit of the enemy relief should outweigh the cost of missing your mutualistic partners. And if that trade-off is working, then you should do or be successful as an invader when you're introduced to a new area. So there's a lot of literature and a lot of people that do research with the enemy release hypothesis, but not too many that work with the mutualist hypothesis. Huh. And then, as far as I know, there's only a handful of studies that have done the two in conjunction.
I feel like they work, they're really important to like understand the entire ecosystem. Like, literally, it's, yeah, nothing is all good or all bad. Like, you need to know what's happening for both.
Exactly. It's the trade-off of the two, yeah. So that's what I'm trying to do, compare the mismutualist hypothesis and the enemy release hypothesis in the one study system between a plant's native range and invasive range. And
so is that, like, it sounds hard because it's a big system. There's a lot of, like, moving things to consider, but also, if it's rare to have done that, does that mean there's not many sort of, I guess, example scaffolds on how to do that research?
Yes and no. Because the enemy release hypothesis is so well studied, we have a lot of, I guess, scaffolds, like you say, a lot of studies that I can use to try and replicate their methods and learn from them when doing my experiment design. While it's not as common to look at the two hypotheses in conjunction, there's still some people that have worked with the Miss Mutualist hypothesis. But even then, because they're so similar, like you're looking at the relative abundance of species and the species richness of the what's interacting in each region, you can set up the same design with both and use that as the comparison.
Okay. It's not like doing two different types of research and then trying to bring it back.
I'm not making it up from scratch, which is very fortunate.
Like a PhD is hard enough.
Yep, I'm coming to learn, so.
Cool. So you have then done field work outside of Cairns, which is where this plant is invasive?
So the species, sickle pod, is quite invasive in tropical Australia, all up Cape York and the northern parts of the Northern Territory in WA. Then actually globally across the tropics, when we look at the distribution maps, it's pretty much been introduced and become invasive in most areas, but it's native to the tropical Americas. So I went to Mexico to study it in the northern end of its native distribution there.
How did you pick that location?
My supervisor had a colleague over there, Professor Victor Paratabla, who is one of the world experts in this area of invasion ecology, or in invasion ecology, I should say. So I was lucky enough that through that connection, I had a professor in a lab that would host me, and that made it so much easier.
Yeah, because there can be a bit of paperwork otherwise.
There was still an extensive amount of paperwork.
Okay. But,
yeah.
What kind of paperwork? Because you sort of think, oh, it's some plants. You're not even, I assume you're not taking them. You're just observing them.
Well,
why do you need paperwork?
I mean, apart from just all of the logistics of travel approvals and whatnot through the universities, the goal is actually to bring back some of the specimen. So here, ooh, there's...
Yeah, suddenly you get a lot of paperwork.
Yeah. Immediately, there's a whole heap of paperwork, which... So because I'm looking at plant-insect interactions, I'm really lucky. Working with vertebrates comes with its whole different world of ethics and whatnot, which I'm so lucky that I don't have to touch any of that. But the insect specimen I intended to bring back, of course, and especially with like the varroa mite outbreaks and whatnot, that's quite high profile at the minute. So bringing back insects wasn't going to be the easiest thing. So I was hoping to do my field work over there, the bare minimum of lab work, and bring back everything else to process. But then there was some changes made when I was there with that decision, because transiting through the US to come back, I wasn't sure what permits they would need, especially just going through the hypotheticals of if I missed a flight in transit and had to leave the airport for a day and didn't have the right permits, what would happen then? So we started some of that paperwork, decided to stop it, and then the plan is also to eventually bring back some of the plant material and the seeds. But at the minute, where actually my supervisor, Dr. Daniel Montesinos, has just been part of a team that's won a grant to build a biosecurity glasshouse in the tropics, and that will be the first one here in Australia. So that's currently about to start being constructed. And then once that's built, we can ship over the seeds and the extra plant material.
Right. I feel like that may not happen before you finish your PhD.
No. As hopeful as Daniel is, I definitely do not see that happening before I finish my PhD, but that's okay. The next person can pick up that project if they're interested in it.
Cool. I mean, that's fascinating in itself. But so what sorts of things were you hoping to do? Like what's the insect you were hoping to pick up? And what were you hoping to do with the insect? What can it tell you?
Oh, okay. That's a really good question. And I have a number of different experiments that I was running. So I think last time we spoke, I was speaking a lot about the buzz pollination syndrome and the plant reproduction.
Which is still fantastic.
Yeah. I love your smile as you say that. I get such a kick out of that syndrome. Like, I still think that's one of the coolest processes that we have ecologically. And for anybody tuning in that doesn't recall it or hasn't listened yet, the certain female bees can exhibit this behavior whereby they have to wrap their body around the male part of the flower and vibrate at an audible frequency, and then those vibrations cause the pollen to spurt out onto their body. So it's quite a specialist interaction. So part of my study is trying to work out, because I'm using pollination as one of the mutualist models or one of the mutualist systems. So working out who's a floral visitor versus who's a pollinator. That's a key question for me. And there's a number of...
The fact that we don't know that just blows my mind. Like, it feels like a basic thing that we should know, and yet we don't. And that's just amazing.
It's so funny how little we know in ecology. Like, that blows my mind. But yeah, you're right. Mm. Just floral visitors versus pollinators, or who's going to be mutualistic in that relationship and who's antagonistic, because are you actually damaging the flower and that has a negative consequence for the plant reproduction? But all of these things, you need to find a way to work out what classes as a pollinator. So obviously that means for this plant, they have to be able to access the pollen, carry that on their body and transfer that to the female part of another flower. So when I'm going through that process to work out whether the insect is carrying the pollen, I can do swabs. So I'll, when we're out in the field looking at the pollinators, we capture them, euthanize them, and then we make up a little jelly stain. And we have these tiny, like 1 millimeter jelly cubes that we swab the insects with. And we can count the pollen grains and we can work out what species of plant the pollen grains coming from, or not always at a species level, but whether or not it's from my study species or not. So we know how good of a pollinator it's going to be.
How do you catch them?
There's a few different techniques. My favorite one is just to put a specimen jar around the flower and close the lid off on it, because usually they're so invested in getting the pollen out of the anthers that they're not too worried when you get really close. There's some exceptions, like I find, especially at home here, the blue banded bees, they don't like it when people come too close to them. So then we have big, like the butterfly nets, and we have an extra meter or so of an arm's length on us, and we can catch them as they're trying to fly off.
This sounds so fiddly.
Yeah, fieldwork can be very fun, very frustrating sometimes when you stand there waiting for a bee to come and then it comes and you miss catching it. But very fun to have a play with and get to be able to capture the insects and then check where the pollen is on their body.
So how far did you need to go out into the forest of Mexico to do your work?
I was pretty lucky, actually. So we were initially thinking that it would grow in what they call a short jungle over there. And we ended up finding them on a lot of farm properties. So it already liked disturbed habitat in its native range, it seems, or at least where we were seeing it in that part of Mexico. But usually there would be a short jungle adjacent to the farming property, and then we didn't have to venture too far, which is good, because as you would know, sometimes, and when I've worked with natives before, you can spend an hour or two trekking up a hill or something, bush bashing through a rainforest just to find one plant. But yeah.
What's short jungle?
Oh, kind of, if you picture a jungle, but then the highest layer of the canopy might have been 6 meters.
That's short.
Yeah. Well, if you picture how tall like trees in our rainforest or in a jungle can be, like 20, 30, 40 meters. So if these trees here were maybe 2 or 3 times my body length, 6 to 10 meters, and that's the top layer of the canopy, it's still dense vine thickets and a jungle, but yeah, short jungle is the translation of what they class that community structure as. But yeah, I was lucky I didn't have to bush bash through a jungle or anything.
Yeah, that could come with different probably pieces of paperwork. So you capture some insects and then swap them with the teeny tiny jelly. That sounds like a very specific skill to have developed. Then count the pollens.
Yep. So for the pollinator study, I have a number of metrics that we use. The number of pollen grains is one of those metrics, as well as how many species of plant the bees visiting or the insects visiting. So we get that from the swabs as well. We also capture them to identify them, because it can be really hard to identify insects to species in the field. And actually, even under a microscope, I really struggle with it. I'm not an entomologist. So I always have to ask the entomologist in the lab and say, is this what this was? But I'm lucky that there's entomologists I can ask. I was also doing body size measurements, because there's been some recent literature that's come out showing for plants with the buzz pollination syndrome, the distance between the male and female components of the flower, so that anther stigma distance, can correlate to, or the body size of the insect relative to that anther stigma distance can predict how good of a pollinator it will be, because it's how likely it's going to be to contact that female part of the flower. So we have like a Goldilocks metric for it. There is the insect too big, too small, or the perfect size? And then that value gets put into the equation as well that I'm putting in to see who's, or ranking who's the most effective pollinator. So doing those measurements, as well as the pollen swabs, as well as the IDs, are the main reasons that I'm capturing the floral visitors.
Is there like a winner so far?
Yes, and it's actually really surprising. In both ranges, there's one species or group of insects that are way out, like magnitudes in front of the other pollinators in their ranking, and neither of them buzz, which surprised me. But for the native range in Mexico, it's the European honeybee, so Apis mellifera.
Oh, it's a bit generic.
I know. And it's not even obviously native to that area. So it's an invasive bee that's helping this plant reproduce in its native range. Whereas over here,
I feel really conflicted about that.
Yeah.
That's a really weird feeling.
I do too. I've like tried to change things in the model to see if I pull out different factors. Is it going to, like, if one factor has a greater weighting than the others, is it just that Apis mellifera is a really good size fit, but it's not abundant, or whatever is going on? But at the minute, no matter how much I play with the data, it keeps coming out as a really good pollinator, which I guess is really good in the sense that at the minute, it's really abundant just about everywhere in the world, and it can be a good pollinator for plants with the buzz pollination syndrome, when so many of the, like, it's one of the main species that is always stated to say this cannot buzz because it can't produce that vibration when it forages on the flowers, so it's not thought to be too good for these plants.
But I assume you've watched this pretty closely. It doesn't seem to be triggering the buzz.
It definitely can't. Physiologically, we're not sure why. There's a team of people actually that are working to try and better understand the bee anatomy and bee physiology and why some species can and some can't buzz. I don't have that physical, or that physics understanding, I should say. But yeah, they definitely cannot buzz, and I've observed hundreds of them in the field. They do not buzz, but they are very good at collecting and depositing the pollen of this plant.
Do they need someone else to have buzzed first?
Right, so no, but often we do see that. They will come in and pick up, we call that the gleaning, when they pick up residual pollen grains after a buzzing pollinator's gone through. But they will also tend to bite the heads of the anthers off. So they just completely destroy the anther, access the pollen.
Okay, so they just go for the brutal approach.
Yeah, pretty much. But I guess it's sufficient for them to get the pollen and the plant somewhat to be able to set fruit.
Lacks elegance. Okay, so European honeybee in Mexico and in Australia?
The stingless bees came out on top there. So, yeah, they tend to exhibit the biting behaviour as well. They can't buzz. And they're actually a lot smaller than that anther stigma distance, so I don't think that they're a fantastic pollinator, but they were just super abundant. So at the minute, it seems to be that if you have just so many individuals doing a role poorly, they will be better than one or two individuals doing a role perfectly.
I'm guessing that's not what you would have hypothesized at the beginning.
Actually, that was my hypothesis to some degree. Like, on paper, well, I had done a literature review, which was recently accepted in the Journal of Ecology, which has been exciting. But it's
congratulations.
Thank you. That's talking about the, in part, invasive plants with the buzz pollination syndrome and whether they're underrepresented globally as invasive species. So whether a specialist pollination syndrome will pose a barrier for introduced species to become invasive. And then for plants like my study species that has a specialist pollination syndrome, how they overcome that. And in that literature review, we were picking up lots of different behaviours. I think there were 8 or 9 different ones in total that insects have been observed to damage anthers, get the pollen, and likely or potentially pollinate these flowers with this syndrome. So that's why I was thinking that perhaps that was what we would see here and that it would be those other behaviours.
They kind of lead the way. Did you observe any difference the plants between here and Mexico? Like, have they sort of changed? Are they happier, sadder?
They, surprisingly, this one goes against my hypotheses, they looked so much sadder in their native range, a lot more stressed in their native range, which in part could be due to that enemy release. It could be because there's a lot more enemies over there. They might have had more herbivory on them. But when I was in Mexico, it was really hot and there was a heat wave that went through. And I think that the plants were just really stressed with the temperatures. It was quite dry in that habitat as well. Whereas here we see them on our farming soils, where it's quite wet in the tropics, of course, well, the wet tropics in Cairns. So they developed a lot quicker over there than what we thought. It's relatively well known that invasive species, they tend to exhibit faster traits in their introduced range. So they'll develop quicker. And that gives them a competitive advantage because they can grow bigger, they can grow quicker, they can occupy new areas, they can reproduce faster and spread faster in turn. But that's kind of the reverse of what we observed last season with this species. I think it was just really stressed. It was trying to say flower, fruit and die as quick as possible.
Huh. So It sort of feels like our native bees are supporting this invader.
Yeah. We Is also there, had...
Can we make it? Oh, sorry. You go.
No, I was just going to say, we also had Apis mellifera come in second over here at the minute. And funnily enough, stingless bees come in second in Mexico at the minute. So both of those groups seem to be doing really well and helping the plant in both of its ranges. But yeah, we saw a lot of our natives visiting and pollinating it over here.
Can you discourage them?
I don't know how you would. Partly because I guess that's such a hard one in terms of theoretically, that's a great way to stop an invasive, but how to discourage a bee from visiting a plant that's so widespread. And we have native plants in the same genus, so the flowers do actually look really similar. And then, of course, with the global bee declines and that being such a hot topic at the minute, I think if you were spraying anything on them and it could potentially affect our native bees, that's not going to be a good solution at all.
Interesting, though. So you have a third field trip to do?
No, I've finished the field work for my project, which is bittersweet. That's always my favourite part of a project. But I had my first field season in, 2022, and then two last year. And at the minute, I'm running a greenhouse experiment. So that's done on campus, which is nice to not have to travel too much or to be, yeah.
So what are you experimenting with the greenhouse?
So this links back to when you were saying about importing the material, because it would ideally I'd do a competition experiment and be able to compare with the seeds from each continent what's going on. But for this experiment, I think in our last interview, I mentioned that I was also looking at how it reproduces and if it can reproduce in the absence of pollinators. And I did a hand pollination experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't think we had the findings from that, though.
Okay, probably not. But it can reproduce in the absence of pollinators, which is good for it, I guess. It would likely contribute to its success as an invader if it doesn't have to rely on those pollinators. But we also saw really high levels of self-compatibility. So it can reproduce with pollen from the same parent plant or from the same individual. So that would make something successful or contribute to its success as an invader, because if you're moved into a new area and you might only have two or three individuals, you don't have to have that outcrossing and have pollen transferred from a different plant. The bee can be visiting, or the insect can be visiting flowers in the same plant.
And they don't end up inbred?
No. Well, we don't know. But they can set fruit and viable seed from that. If you have that happening long term, that's where theoretically you get inbreeding depression. But I've hand pollinated with pollen from the same individual, hand pollinated with pollen from a different individual, and I'm now sowing those seeds to see whether there's a fitness effect of that self pollen. So I have those seeds sown at the minute in the greenhouse. But then I've asked a few too many questions as usual. So I'm also seeing whether the drought stress affects them, because after seeing how affected they were in Mexico and how stressed the plants looked there, I want to know whether, drought and those extreme weather events are going to be having an effect on the plant. Mm-hmm. And then we're also trying to assess whether there's a competition effect, because usually when we see the plants, they're in really dense stands with each other. So if they're competing with each other for the same resource, do we end up with two weaker plants as opposed to one strong one? Or are they just so good at being weeds and plants that it doesn't matter and there's no, they don't have a competition effect at all? So I'm running an experiment where, sowing, I've got gosh, a few hundred pots at the minute, some exposed to a drought treatment, some water available treatment. I know the pollen source of every one of the seeds, and then some are being sown alone by themselves or some in competition with each other.
That's a lot of plants.
Yes. There's a lot going on with this experiment. And like I said, ideally, like, this is all with the Australian seeds because we haven't been able to import the Mexican ones yet. But ideally, you'd run all of this in the invasive range and all of that in the native range to get a full picture of what's going on. But that's the next person's problem because my project will be done by then.
Yeah. And you need to scope back. So what's a drought treatment? Like, does that just mean you don't water them when they look sad?
Pretty much. I have a lot of sensors, which at the minute they don't seem to be working too well, but I should be able to monitor the water content in each of the pots. And yeah, you can also feel when the soils are a bit drier, and you can see it on the plants when the leaves start to wilt. So it's a case of trying to find the perfect balance of not killing the plant while stressing it out.
And you didn't need ethics approval for that?
No. Fortunately for plants, no ethics is ever needed.
How long do they take to grow? Like, how long is this experiment going to take you?
So the goal is for it to be around the 100-day mark. I think by then they should hopefully start to develop some flowers, and I can do a flower count as my last response variable, and then I'll harvest them. That's the goal.
Harvest them for what?
I'll be measuring their biomass. So I'll be looking at the dry weight of them. So yeah, that's when I'll end the experiment. But we'll wait and see, because they might flower early, or I might kill them all by then. No, I hope I don't kill them.
This seems like a kind of intense experiment. For some reason, this seems way more intense than trying to catch bugs. Like, trying to keep plants alive is a bit hit and miss.
I agree. It's really funny. I've moved into a new rental and all I want to do is get plants and build a garden. And then I come home each day after the greenhouse and I think, oh gosh, I do not want to water any plants right now or have to keep anything alive. Like, this experiment is stressing me out way more than anything else on my project.
Watering plants has turned into work.
Yeah, it's okay. I'd still take it over any desktop job.
Definitely. What are you hoping, I guess, the whole combination of everything to end up, I guess, being or looking like at the end of your PhD?
I don't know. I think at the minute, it looks like my thesis will tell the story that none of my hypotheses have really been supported. But it should be a nice little stitch up of, here's the plant-insect interactions in the native range versus the invasive range. So hopefully we can see whether there is that loss or the benefit of the enemy release is outweighing the cost of the missed mutualists, and whether that's going to be influencing plants and their spread as they keep shifting around the world. Or maybe it's something completely different that's contributing to plant invasions.
It does feel like there's a few factors, like, because you haven't even spoke about soil yet.
No, and I didn't look at the soil for my project, but there's actually some really interesting research from a couple of different labs where they use the soil microbiome to assess these hypotheses. And like you say, there's so many interactions and so many processes that can influence how a species becomes invasive or whether an introduced species does become invasive.
Yeah. Or whether it just sort of like dies in its tracks.
Yeah.
Which we never hear about because you don't have to worry about it.
Exactly. But the majority of species won't ever become invasive. Like the majority of introduced species, there's a loose tens rule. So 10% of introduced species will become invasive, or 10% of introduced species will establish, and 10% of those established species will actually become invasive. So it's a really small proportion that do, and yet they have such a disproportionate effect on the ecosystems. Like, they're up with climate change, with one of the key threats to native biodiversity and whatnot. So maybe my research will contribute one little drop to help build the picture of why species or which traits enable species to become invasive.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, it's been a great adventure for me.
Well, that in itself is sufficiently valid, but like, it's always cool to make the world more knowledge. It's fascinating, isn't it? And so complex.
Yeah, so incredibly complex. But it's cool to get to think about each day.
Big to think about each day. Do you think there's any chance that, I guess, the approach that you have taken could inform how we understand other invasive species? Like, obviously, it could apply to other species.
I would say hopefully. I hope it does, because I think, and like I said, sickle pod or this plant is just my model system, and using pollination or any of the other processes and any of those other interactions, they're just the model system to test these big theoretical ecology ideas. And like, there was some modeling that came out on trying to predict the spread of an invasive plant in Australia. And they were saying under climate conditions and plant-insect interactions, and they were actually one of the first papers to incorporate plant-insect interactions into the spread of an invasive species, but it was predicted to spread from Queensland south into New South Wales. But now if we look at just the findings from my literature review that say because of this pollinator behaviour, actually any plant with this syndrome doesn't need a buzzing pollinator, then incorporating that into a model isn't going to be the most effective way to predict how a plant will spread or how a plant with that syndrome will spread. So
yeah,
I hope that the findings, even just from that small part, can help with that at least.
Just help make models better in general.
Yeah.
So what does the next year look like for you?
My next year? Finishing up this experiment will be the big one in the coming few months. And then I've got about 12 months left on my scholarship to try and do all of my analysis and writing. So it will be a hectic 12 months of pushing out hopefully 3 papers, but we'll see how it goes. I knew at the very start of this project, designing it so that I needed all of the data before I could do my analyses wasn't going to be ideal, because I couldn't stagger through the writing and whatnot as it went. But that's okay. It's been a great couple of years so far, or just over. And then, yeah, I'll have 12 months of crunch time to write.
So is that a lot of just data analysis and like stats? And do you... Yeah. How do you do it?
Yep. Mostly stats. So I've started in the last couple of months tidying up the Mexico and Australia data for 3 of my experiments. But because last year I had 2 back-to-back field seasons, like I had a whole lot of ants and insects that I collected in the field and then left in the lab here to process, and then went to Mexico to do the same. So now I have to go back and start doing the identifications for them a bit more thoroughly and working out how I do the stats on those to compare, be it any one of my response variables, which at the minute my issue is that I have way too much data and I don't know how to synthesize that into 2 or 3 figures for a paper. It's like, oh, what's the best story here? But yes, it's starting to spend a lot of time playing with the data and seeing what trends I can pull out and what's the most interesting story it tells.
Yeah. It'll be, you're sort of now a detective in your own pile of data. Like, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's actually exactly how it feels. And I really like that bit of a project, getting to see whether the trends are true.
Yeah. And because you'll have your own biases of what you've sort of observed in the field and what you feel like you've caught a whole lot of this particular type of bee, and then whether or not that turns out to be true with the numbers will be kind of interesting too.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a risk of bias in like you caught specific, like you were more likely to catch specific bees?
For the pollinators, of course, some species are easier than others to capture. This is not my first project capturing pollinators, though. So I think over time, you learn the behavior of like, oh, this one's going to fly backwards. So if I put a jar at the base of it, it'll fly straight into it. So it's just all those little things that you pick up over time. There are some species that I don't think like being around at all when people are there. So I also put out video cameras. So we have camera analyses as well that we go through and watch the recordings, make sure that, or see whether we're getting the same species that we're seeing in person as to on the cameras. And we can also analyze their behavior in a slightly different way when we record them on the cameras. So we get some different variables and whatnot that we can put into those equations too.
That makes sense. That sounds like very solid, like covering all the bases.
I'm trying to. I think there's so many ways that you can do a pollinator study. And yeah, to answer my questions, which are very specific about what behavior enables somebody to extract or a species to extract the pollen, and then whether that same species will also deposit it on the stigma. I try to be really thorough to get all of the stages of that process.
I think it's impressive.
Well, thank you. It's lots of fun. I think either being out in the field watching bees land on flowers or sitting at my desk with a good playlist and watching videos of bees landing on flowers. It's a bit of a win-win.
It does sound good. Is there any advice that you would give to Laura like 12 months ago?
Oh my gosh, input data in Excel the right way the first time.
Oh.
That is, yeah. I think I have a folder of like data tidying, hope you never have to open this again. Maybe because I changed between the ranges, the layout of my data sheet, and then merging them has not been the most fun task. But that's okay. It was a day's task to get it all done, and at least it's all tidy again. But yes, if I could have told myself that 12 months ago and just made all of my data inputted correctly, it would have made life a little bit easier for this week at least.
Good life advice generally.
Yeah, which I know every supervisor and everybody else has always says that, but yes.
Is there anything we haven't spoken about that you'd like to share?
No, I think we've just about covered all of the updates on my project since I was last on.
Awesome. I mean, it's sounding like it's like hurtling along fantastically, so.
It feels like a sprint at the minute. I blink and every day goes. There's so much to do, but it's all fun stuff, which is good.
That helps. That helps. In that case, to wrap up, have you got a shout out for us, a virtual high five?
Oh, I want to give my virtual high five to the lab that I did my research with in Mexico. I think I mentioned Victor Paratabla, but their whole lab group was just so amazing. They were my drivers and translators and field assistants, and they just made the whole experience so enjoyable and easy. I was never alone in the field over there because they always made sure that there was an extra undergrad or somebody who could come with me and help out, which enabled me to run 3 experiments at once. So very lucky with that.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully maybe you guys can host some of them as well.
Yeah, I really hope so. It would be great to be able to return that favor. Plus, any excuse to go out in the field.
Well, high five to that lab and for being so welcoming and supportive. That's awesome. Cool. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Laura. It has been delightful. And any day we get to talk about buzz pollination is a good day. So thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back on, Amelia. It's been great.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee, head to avidresearch.com.au and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.